Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
My guest today is Sergey Antonov, that's written Bankrupts and Usurers of Imperial Russia, Debts, Property and the Law in the Age of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, Harvard UP 2016. And this week, we are going to discuss something I wanted to cover for quite a long time. We are going to discuss the Romanov dynasty of Russia. And of course, in the traditions of the podcast, as we always begin with, how did you come to study? You mainly study, focus on late Tsarist history, but we are going to be, in this episode, going to focus from how the Romanov got to power and to the chapter in the Great Reign. And next week, we are going to discuss Paul I until Nicholas II. But of course, how did you begin to study Tsarist history?
Sure. Well, hello, Ireland, and it's a real pleasure to be here. The response to that is I'm a legal historian, over 20 years ago, I was actually a lawyer in New York City, but I always knew I wanted to do history. I wanted to be a professional historian for a very long time, and the historical subject that attracted me was Russian law, it was immediately obvious to me that like anybody who does read classical Russian literature knows that there were these amazing trials with a lot of emotion, public participation, juries, just all the famous literary figures like, Dostoevsky were writing about that. And I wanted to learn more about that world. This is a little bit of an unusual career path. I would say a lot more of my colleagues or historians of Russia, they focus on the Soviet Union and the 20th century. To me, the feeling was that the feeling that I had was that I really needed to understand how we came to 1917 and the Soviet transformation, and especially in terms of institutions, law, power, and government. I felt like I really wanted to know how all of these things worked under the Tsars. So that's kind of a brief answer.
So, of course, most people think that Peter the First, or Peter the Great, if you will, was the first Romanov, because most people, most historians in the world, begin usually when they write Romanov history, begin with Peter the First. But as a matter of fact, there were two Romanovs before Peter the Great, who's not so well known. And we don't begin with how the Romanovs came to power. And I would also like to address that they were present in the court, even Russian court, even before they came to power for quite a long time, weren't they?
Yes, absolutely. And the Romanov dynasty, I mean, who they basically were, I mean, to be basically blunt, they were essentially a boyar family. And a boyar, B-O-Y-A-R, is just a Russian term for an aristocrat. So this is basically like old Russian entrenched aristocracy. And there were, several hundred of the various clans and family groups. And the Romanovs was just one of the many, 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 many sort of trees, many branches on that trees. And one of them, Anastasia, was actually married to Ivan the Fourth, Ivan the Terrible. Somebody from that clan. And so basically the Romanovs had these kind of connections with the ruling circles, for quite a long time. But to be absolutely clear about this, they were not super duper influential. Like they were not like anywhere within like the top dozen of families. They were, they were just out there, but they were not calling the shots, let's put it this way, until the early 17th century.
So how did it come? Because as you know, it even the terrible died, and we had the times of troubles, as they've
Yes.
known. So how did the Romanos come to power? Because
Yes.
as well you said, they weren't really influential. So how did they learn, to say it, to put it this way, for lack of better words, learn themselves
Yes.
into becoming the ruling dynasty all the way into the early 20th century?
So there are really two aspects to that. So for centuries, the sort of the land that we know of today as Russia went through all kinds of different configurations. But for centuries, that part of the world was seen as let's put it this way, like a domain of one particular family. We call it dynasty today. But back then, I think they thought more of like a family of rulers, that came back from the mythical Rurik prince, Prince Rurik from 9th century. And historians are still arguing whether he actually came from Scandinavia, or but clearly from some part in the, of the Baltic. And essentially, people who were ruling Russia or Rus claimed some claimed descent from him. And by the time of the early 17th century, there were, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these people, and most of them you know, had some kind of title of a prince especially, but only sort of the senior sort of the senior ruling branch that died out during the time of troubles. You know, they actually by you know by the late 16th century, like, actually had a viable claim that they were going to rule. But at the same time, there are several families that are, they think of themselves as almost as senior, definitely more senior than the Romanovs, right? And so the question is, when the time of troubles was over, when sort of the Moscow ruling elites kind of worked their issues, when it became clear that the Polish prince, you know, Vladislav, wasn't after all going to be really allowed to hold a throne in Moscow. So the, you know, the basically the boyars, the princes, aristocrats, they tried to figure out who they were going to put on the throne. They've tried several different families previously, the Godunov, they tried the Shuiskys, but they basically came up with somebody who they thought wasn't going to be a big threat to them. So that's kind of like the second answer. So first of all, there is this idea that the sort of the Imperium, right? The sort of the state in Russia belongs to a certain group of people, and the second is that they chose the one who was the least threatening. Now Mikhail was just a teenager; he was this young guy, didn't really show the Mikhail Romanov, the very first Romanov Tsar, wasn't really a big personality, but his father was. His father, who was the, you know, Filaret, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. Was kind of basically the ruler behind the scenes for a very long time. So that I hope that kind of begins to explain what is a really complex complex history.
Now, a lot of the historians, and that's probably why they choose to begin with Peter the Great, they kind of paint Mikhail and his successor, just a second here, that I need to make sure I get the name right, Alexis, that they paint them kind of as irrelevant, but they are the first Romanovs nonetheless that makes history relevant, so to speak. But when we spoke before the podcast, you disagree that they are not really irrelevant. So what
Oh,
was
yes.
the reign like, and for the first two Romanovs up until Peter the Great?
Absolutely. Or even we want to say the first three Romanovs, because so first there was Mikhail, then there was Mikhail's, and Mikhail reigned from 1613 until, I think, was it 1645, something like that. And then there was Alexei, who was Peter the Great's father. And then the third Romanov was Peter the Great's older brother, Fyodor, who basically died as a teenager. He was an sickly character, but at the same time, Alexei and Fyodor were extremely important. Now, just to sort of explain to you why we are thinking, well, a lot of sort of people think today that, oh, okay, the Romanovs begin with Peter the Great. It wasn't really any kind of, you know, Western conspiracy against Russia. It wasn't anything like that. It was really sort of Russian historians themselves who were, trying to come up with a kind of vision of Russian history, that, that they wanted to kind of project publicly. And so it was the Russian historians in the 19th and then also the 20th century, who kind of glorified Peter the Great, so much that everything before Peter, they were trying to, make it look like it was all, backward, barbaric, Asiatic, and so on. But to tell you the truth, even, Peter himself and all of his leading statesmen, they were very aware that most of the things that they did, most of the reforms that they carried out in the early 18th century, they were first introduced by Peter's father in the second half of the 17th century. I think it's very clear that, there's this kind of German term Satellite, meaning like the time of transition. And there were like two, I would say, in this early imperial Russian history, two like really important transitional periods. One was the 15th century, when the Russians decided that they wanted to have a particular kind of state, an imperial, militaristic, sort of very tightly centralized kind of state. So that was the first period. And the second one was under Peter's father, when the Russians decided that they were going to have, again, go back to this very organized, very focused, autocratic, I would say autocratic, regime, where basically the top, top figures, aristocrats, boyars, and so on, they would have some power, but they would not call the shots, right? So, and this is basically the kind of transformation that Alexei presided over. But I could give you a sort of a very long list of what he's done, but stop me if you want. Like, for example, one key item, a regular army, right, that supposedly Peter the Great had created. That's quite a bit misleading, because actually there were two or three attempts to do so. One was in the during the time of Troubles. The other one was in the 1630s, when Moscow was fighting a war against Poland. And then finally, the most successful attempt was under Alexei, who basically started the kind of European style regiments, and they were basically there to stay. And under Peter the Great, they were gradually, renamed and reorganized. But like, the idea was that you are going to have a standing army, officered and trained according to kind of Western European manuals. No, that all comes from the 1650s. Like, that all comes from, 50 years before Peter the Great did his stuff. So the military part is just one small example. But even cultural influences, if you look at his kind of contemporary depictions of Tsar Alexei, he's dressed up in this traditional Muscovite robes, right? So you think, ah, he's like this sort of religious guy who just sits in his palace, right? Like sort of an icon of some kind. And I know that's very misleading. He was actually very hands-on. I mean, they called him Alexei the Quiet, but it was more of a kind of like an ironic sort of name. I mean, he was very forceful, not like Peter, but very forceful guy, liked to go to battle. He was very much, welcoming to welcoming Western European culture, except that, as you know, Ivan the Terrible and Mikhail, like, for example, that Ivan the Terrible's mother was a Lithuanian princess, basically kind of brought up in this kind of Western culture. So in other words, they were, by the kind of West that the Russians were dealing with in the 16th and 17th century, it was basically Polish culture. So it wasn't the Dutch or the German culture or the English culture, right? So Peter the Great had in his head, the Dutch and German models, and Peter's father had, Polish models. So under Alexei, the Russians, they started a newspaper, they had theater. A lot of Russian aristocrats were already dressed in Western European outfits. They had collections of Western books, and they taught their children, Polish, Latin, German, and so on. And this is where my kind of transition comes in, because Alexei's older son, Fyodor, who was indeed sickly and who did indeed die young after just ruling for a few years, he was just kind of like a Peter the Great, in a sort of a better version, basically. You know, he was a nicer guy, let's put it this way. Had a
Now,
better
I'm
personality.
sorry to stop you right there, but because you mentioned Fyodor, and that's been like this is perfect translation, because according to a Norwegian historian on who wrote about the Russian Empire, he mentioned that he had a pro-rule with Peter at the time when they come to power, that this hasn't happened before, in that this was really unique in Europe, that the for the first time there were two rulers on the same throne through two brothers ruling
Oh,
at the same time, if that's correct. So was it really that
right.
unique that they both would be co-rulers?
Yes, this is actually gets even more complicated. So there were basically three brothers. So first it was Fyodor. He was the older brother, right? And he ruled from 1776 until 1780. I'm sorry, 1676 to 1682, and then he died. And then there were two younger brothers, Piotr and Ivan, or Ivan the Fifth, as he was known, who did in fact became co-rulers, which was basically a result of of palace maneuverings and palace intrigues. Okay, but so I'll get to these younger guys in a moment. But first, I just want to say that Fyodor was kind of like a very promising guy. He had, even though he was very young, he was very like he had like a very sort of forceful personality. He was like very conscious of like his duty to be. He's kind of like a hands-on ruler. He was very well educated. Was very familiar with Western culture. Was very literate. So very, 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 very promising. Except that, like I said, he died young. But this does show you the kind of court culture that existed in this late Muscovite period, where it was not at all about like guarding yourself from evil Western influences. Quite the opposite. It was all about sort of opening yourself up, and just like seeing what the latest models were. And in the similar vein, Piotr or Peter of the future, Peter the Great, and his core ruler for a few years, Ivan the Fifth. They were also kind of brought up. Like, I mean, they were also brought up to be, not just kind of figureheads, but to be basically acquainted with, with languages, to be acquainted with, what Western European culture was supposed to be. Now, here's the trick, though. So, from the very beginning, when the two boys, Piotr and Ivan, when they were very young, it was clear that the future Peter the Great was a lively, intelligent little thing, right? Whereas Ivan the Fifth just didn't look as promising. Let's put it this way. I mean, he would grow up and have children. His daughter would become the empress later on. He's a descendant of his other child would also rule Russia for a brief period of time. So like Ivan was a real person. He wasn't just some kind of disabled kind of man, but he wasn't nearly as promising as Peter. And so the idea was to just put Peter on the throne by himself. But however, because there were, the way Muscovite Russia was run is that there were all this, various court factions, various boyar clans who were fighting each other for influence, then there was basically a riot. And so Peter's supporters were forced to basically share power with Ivan's supporters. Just to make this, I mean, I don't think there's any easier way to put this, but just because that's what we have. We have these faction politics, and various boyar clans.
And you mentioned European influence, and I'm sure we'll get back to this eventually. But when you see it, look at St. Petersburg, it is clear that Peter the Great, or Peter, he was very heavily influenced by European towns when he built it. So it's clear that the European influence was still welcome. And as you know, French would be the language of the court that people would speak at the time, at least for a very, very, very long time under Catherine the Great as well. So it's clear that European influence was really, for a long time, welcome into the
Yes,
Russian world.
absolutely. Later on, especially in the middle of the 18th century, it is true that Russian aristocracy basically learned French, and this kind of court culture became Francophone. Now, earlier in the 18th century, I mean, German was very, very important. And as to the sort of earlier years of Peter the Great, I mean, they would learn. A lot of people would learn Polish. People would learn German. People would learn. know, to some extent, you know, Latin. There was even this like a first important institution of higher learning in this kind of late Muscovite period. It was known as Slavic Latin and Greek Academy. Now there's the one actually really important point here that I think I have to mention is that yet another important introduction by Tsar Alexei was, of course, to incorporate about half of what is today's Ukraine into the Russian Empire. Okay. And so when Ukrainian Cossacks rebelled against the King of Poland in the 1640s, they kind of tried to kind of figure out, like, they tried to have their own independent state, and that wasn't going to work. They tried to go over to the Crimean Tatars and their overlords, the Ottomans. But eventually, it turns out that the Russian Tsar was the best bet, right? And so there was this kind of a union with obviously Muscovy, the Muscovite Russia as the senior partner. Lots of warfare, just very bloody period of Eastern European history. But basically, in the mid 1650s, about what is known as the left bank Ukraine, right? In other words, everything that was on the eastern side of the Dnieper River was joined to the Russian state. And the result of that is that there were these large numbers of I guess proto-Ukrainian, we can put it, no nobles, but also churchmen, you know, intellectuals. A lot of them were educated in Western Europe, like in Rome, for example, where there was like a separate, even like a separate college for training Eastern European clergy. So a lot of these people ended up in Moscow, and kind of like bringing this kind of new cultural influences with them also, right? So that's, I think I needed to point that
Yeah,
out.
and you mentioned the Cossack Revolt, and of course, I mentioned this before, I think, but you know, one of the reasons I believe that Putin used to justify his invasion to use to compare to modern to the today is that the when the Cossacks signed their deal with the Saint sorry Moscow and Saint Petersburg wasn't created yet, but when they signed the deal, they would indefinitely tie their bonds to Russia, and this I believe you Putin uses today as well. To mention, oh, they signed a deal in that Ukraine indefinitely, and it still counts. That's partly why he uses this justification for his current invasion of Ukraine, right?
Well, there's a long list, right? But in terms of just if we were kind of leaving out the sort of the rhetoric and ideology for the moment, but just in pure practical terms of empire building, this was a if you get this kind of cultured, prosperous, very numerous bunch of people under your control. So after the 1650s, Russia was a very different state. Like a very different culture. I mean, I think it's just like that's just kind of like different. Difficult. It's impossible to deny that. But nothing in terms of justifications for the invasion. That would have to be different podcast. Kind of a big
Yeah,
subject.
but let's go back to Peter. I'm sorry for this a little bit, but just you mentioned a revolt, and I do believe this is the one you refer to, where in Moscow and Peter himself, he would resent. He wasn't very fond of that Moscow, which is partly why he founded Saint Petersburg later on. But there was a revolt, I believe, where they almost went into the palace where they lived, but his mother, I think, brought both of the sons out, I believe the story goes, to the terrace, and she talked to the crowd and she calmed them down. So that's one of the reasons I think why Peter resented and later on built St. Petersburg.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point that you're making because if you think like if you had to rule Russia in the early 18th century, and I think like pretty much any sane person would think, okay, I would build maybe a port city, maybe a fortress, in the middle of these swamps of Ingria, right, or Izhora, as the Russians called it earlier. But yeah, like why would you want to build this sort of giant capital, which to this day, right, is extraordinarily important economically and politically in all kinds of ways. But Peter the Great did in fact, no, before he became the Great, did in fact face, a lot of resistance, a lot of uprisings, just in every possible way. That's just included, I mean, that did include his military forces, his musketeers. That also involved a lot of Cossacks in the south, in what today is Ukraine and South Russia. So there was a lot of dissent. It was a very violent, unstable, basically society. One issue that heavily contributed to all that unrest was the church schism that also started under Peter the Great's father. Just so you get like one extra that we have to thank Alexei for. So part of Alexei's program of state building. He and his patriarch, head of the church, Nikon, Nikon, basically they carried out this kind of like a worship and liturgy reform. They basically wanted to upgrade church books to sort of eliminate the inaccuracies and also correct certain bits of ritual that, unless you are actually an active practicing Orthodox Christian, this really doesn't sound as like super important, like which way you circle the altar and how many fingers you use to cross yourself. However, this was just kind of the top of the iceberg because at stake was really like who gets to control spirituality, religious life, right? Something was really, really important in the 17th century. And to what extent like these issues can be just, can be reorganized and restructured at the sovereign's command. It was a really, really big deal. And as a result, there was a very large following in the Orthodox Church that rejected the reform and started the alternative, what is known today as the Old Belief Movement, Old Believers, that are still very active. They exist. And they were extremely active in the 17th and early 18th century. And so a lot of the musketeers who rebelled against Peter the Great, a lot of the Cossacks who rebelled against Peter the Great, they were Old Believers. They rejected this kind of state intrusion in their spiritual life, they basically thought the Tsar was Antichrist, to put it bluntly.
No,
So that's.
so sorry for the, if I interrupted you, but let's talk about, because you mentioned his military reforms, and one of the things Peter, I think, is unique for is that he, as a child, he created this, and it was very interesting in the sea as well, as he would build, I believe, the first navy with in Russia, and he was so excited about sailing ships and so on. But one of the unique things I think about his childhood is that he created this, so he began as a play regiment with among his closest friend, and it kind of grew and grew. And he would later, he would not style himself of general at first. He would, kind of begin from bottom and then promote himself further on as he gained experience. And later on, this regiment, I believe, would become very important and vital to the Russian military.
Yes, absolutely. That is a sort of a very good issue to get into because, I mean, both the Navy and the Imperial Guard, I mean, it's kind of ironic because Russia is mostly a land country, right? But like to this day, in terms of, if we think just in terms of, security, as a sort of a, as a policy issue, as a historical issue, Russia just like it cannot be militarily secure without a competent navy, and that's kind of ironic. Even during World War II, when the Soviet Union was invaded, by land, right, by the Nazi Germany and its allies, just the various weaknesses in the naval area were just very, very, very severe, both in the Black Sea, in the Arctic, in the Baltic. It's a whole separate story. And so this was also the case in the 17th century when the only access to the sea that Russia had was through, through the White Sea, right, through very extreme north that basically freezes over most of the year. Historically, the lands ruled by these kind of what we call Russian quote unquote princes had access to the Baltic Sea through the land around what today is St. Petersburg, and until the early 17th century, when after the time of troubles, it was basically kind of like a concession to Sweden to kind of like leave the Russians alone, right? Now, look, this does not mean that I don't want to be very clear about this. This doesn't mean that the the Russians were just kind of completely blocked from outside trade. This does not mean that Peter the Great, you know, urgently needed to get access to the sea as some kind of window to the West. Because let's put it this way, you know, Sweden was perfectly happy to provide that kind of window. There were, you know, there were certain strategic questions because whenever, whenever there was some kind of warfare on Russia's western borders, it would be really easy to block, you know, all kinds of supplies going in through, you know, from Western Europe. Like, for example, say you wanted to purchase weapons or hire some, you know, mercenaries in the West, it would be very easy to block their, you know, their arrival to Russia. And remember, this is 17th, 18th century. Like the idea of a modern nation at arms, a standing army, still doesn't quite exist. So basically, whenever a war starts, the first thing you do is you hire a bunch of officers, right? You hire officers in the Russian situation. A lot of them are going to be foreigners. And then you give them commissions. And then these officers raise their regiments. You know, this kind of like harm how the arm on an army worked in the 18th century. And so to have access to trade, to this kind of access to military goods, to say purchasing guns, hiring personnel, you know, it was really, really a key strategic issue. So Peter the Great was not the first one to come up with the idea that, oh, Russia needs a navy. Probably the first, kind of like the first real example of that was under Ivan the Terrible in the mid 16th century, when he hired a whole fleet by run by Danes, basically by the Danes. He was allied with the Danes. Who were just kind of privateering in the Baltic for him. And then Peter's father, again, we're going back to Peter's father. He actually did try to build a navy, but because he didn't really have any good sea to build it on, he built it on the Volga River that had access to the Caspian Sea. And from the Caspian Sea, you could sail to Iran. So it was an important trade route. So there were, you know, so there were like several boats that were built, and they were burned by rebels. So it was an unsuccessful experiment. And so Peter just kind of like inherited this awareness that if you want to be a great ruler, you needed to build boats. So that's one part of it. And I'm, you know, happy to talk more about naval issues if you know if that's where you want to go. But
I'm afraid we don't have the
yeah, it's too much. But the Imperial Guard is the other thing. Yes, and I think you're absolutely right. It started, look, I mean, every European country had an Imperial Guard of some kind, but like in Russia, it was much more important than just a bunch of elite soldiers who guarded the ruler. It was this kind of like a state within a state almost, right? So they started out as just basically being Peter's, you know, the kind of his followers, almost his bodyguards in a
time.
sense. Just basically, they then people to whom he could give an important mission. Say, like, if he wanted to send an important embassy to, I don't know, Iran, for example, you're going to get one of your Imperial Guard officers. He's going to go and do it. And so as these people matured and got experience, they became this kind of core of the sort of later Petrine military force. Officers, elite soldiers, just kind of, yeah, they're really sort of the heart of the military. It's kind of like both the Rangers and the Green Berets and the Marines in today's US military put together, just kind of people that who basically underpinned Peter's power. Like, I hope that explains it a little bit.
So something as well we have to talk about is what he's because we mentioned European influence, and one of the things that Peter chose to do is to travel incognito in Europe and goes to among Amsterdam, and I find it rather amusing that shows when he was in Amsterdam because as again we mentioned boat buildings and learned the boat craft there, and it was not to be referred to as he would refuse to answer to Tsar Peter. Would be called Carpenter Peter, which I find rather amusing. And he as well would visit Paris and Amsterdam. So let's talk about his journey because it does become important to him later as well, his journey to Europe.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful question, really. And maybe we can sort of go back to it over and over again because there were other Russian rulers who would do similar things, you know, in part inspired by Peter the Great. But yes, so Peter did go when was very, very young. Was it 1697, 98, I believe is the year. I may be just off by 1 or 2 years, but basically he's still very young. He's just seized the throne recently in his own name from his older sister, who was a regent. Never mind, it's a long story, but But yeah, but a Russian ruler just kind of going to Europe as a private person. I mean, it was really, really just kind of earth-shattering. It was, unprecedented. Earlier tsars, they would have taken to the field as, commanders. And Ivan the Terrible did it. Alexei did it. Ivan the Third in the 15th century did it. But to actually like go to Western Europe, especially go as a private person, that's really just, I mean, no, it's no surprise that there were all kinds of conspiracy theories that appeared later on that, real Peter the Great was murdered and by the Dutch, and they sent an imposter in instead, which, is not what happened, right? So first thing is that everybody knew that it wasn't just some random dude traveling to Australia. Everybody knew that it
I
was a
mean,
Russian Tsar.
it is too big to be really incognito, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, everybody knew. But the second thing, he didn't just like travel by himself, right? It was the so-called Grand Embassy. So it was a big embassy of, Russian boyars and clerks and diplomats who went to Europe to drum up an alliance against the Ottoman Empire, right? So because, the Turks were the big enemies to a lot of European countries, they besieged Vienna just very recently at that point. It was kind of like the last sort of surge of the Ottoman expansion into Europe. And so Peter had all the reason to expect that he would find some allies that would allow him to kind of fight off this Ottoman onslaught again in what today is Ukraine that was ongoing at that time. So Peter was hoping to find allies. And so the idea was is that the premise, the legend was that he was just this a regular nobleman who was just attached to the embassy, right? So that was the idea. But he wasn't just like putting his life in danger or anything like that, right? He, had bodyguards and friends and boyars and advisors, and so nobody was under any illusion who he was. So that's just kind of one issue. The second issue, and I think it's very important, is just we have to like realize that people in the 18th century, they were kind of like us in many ways, but they were also different in many ways. And so this idea of a ruler, having a hobby, a ruler of a country who liked woodwork, right? This is really nothing unusual to us today, right?
I mean, Abdulhamid II as well in the late 19th century was a great woodworker, and that was his passion as well, to mention another someone else, another ruler that had a hobby that's kind of similar
Yeah.
in the woodworking.
Yeah, exactly. So like having those kind of activities, that it was really sort of really just part of this early Enlightenment sort of outlook. Like he was supposed to have some kind of practical hand-on experience, and you see it over and over again. But it's not just that. I want to like draw this sort of longer picture from Peter the Great in these early years to say Peter the Great's old drunken assembly, right? Which is we can mention if you want right now. Which was basically these really bizarre rituals when they would Peter the Great would dress some of his courtiers as this kind of like fake clergy, and supposedly making fun of the Catholic clergy, but like it's not very clear that the Russians around him understood all the issues. So right, so to us it looks like a really bizarre thing. So these several hundred of these guys with Peter at their head, they get really drunk, and they dress up in these bizarre costumes, and they have these bizarre mock rituals. Quasi mock religious rituals. So, like, why in the world people would do that, right? And there is this sort of a book about France in a slightly early period by Robert Darnton. It's called Darnton. It's called The Great Cat Massacre. It basically just shows that people in the early era, I mean, they were still intelligent, interesting, creative people, but like some of the practices and ideas and things people found fun or funny, they're different from things that we find fun or funny today, right? And
I
so,
mean, this goes even back to the 70s, right? People things that were funny even just as not as far as the 70s are not funny today necessarily.
yes, it's a
So
good point,
you don't have to
exactly.
go far back to
Yes,
see that humor
exactly.
has changed.
Yes, exactly, right? So, like, these kind of things change considerably. And so we really shouldn't be surprised that like a ruler of a vast empire, goes dresses up as this normal outfits, works as a carpenter somewhere. Then he goes to England and, trashes his place where he's staying. It was just a normal. That's what 18th century people did. I want to say that. But also this old drunken assembly. That's also just to have these kind of bizarre rituals. It really wasn't, you know, it really wasn't anything particularly out of the ordinary. And from there
And
we went.
again, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but something we should mention as well, and this was un really uncommon at court either, that was he was fond of dwarves as well, or little people, if you
Yeah.
will. There were a lot of, maybe so kind of functioning as jesters in a way to amuse. And again, we
Yes.
have to take a look at this in a 17th century
Absolutely.
perspective, but at that time, of course, it was more amusing for them, not like today where we have a different view, of course, where they are, do forgive
No.
me for the expression, for the lack of better words, like us. But back then there were different view on dwarfism and, if you will, little people as well, because they were really high in court as well.
Absolutely, right. So today, like, we don't think that, you know, having people with disabilities, you know, beat each other up in front of you, that it's particularly a funny,
No.
humorous activity. Or but like you said, we don't necessarily have to go all the way back to the 18th century. Look at, for example, various ethnographic museums, quote unquote, that existed, you know, all over Europe until, you know, very quite recently, actually, where you had like entire like families and villages
And
from, you know.
searches in the 30s were full of this.
Yeah, like you had a whole like villages of you know, people from, you know, Africa or South America, from Southeast Asia, would be just transported to, I don't know, Belgium. That was supposed to be this like big attraction, right? It sort of existed, you know, all over the Western world, quote unquote. But in the 18th century, in whether it's, you know, Russia or Western Europe, there was this very bizarre a bizarre approach to entertainment, to put it this way. And when we talk about the Ice House and the Empress Anna after Peter the Great, that's just a continuation. Continuation of this sort of a very different understanding of power, entertainment, emotion, imagery. We can sort of go on more about it if you want.
Of course, unfortunately, we have a lot of history to cover, so, and I'm doing plan to cover most of this eventually on the podcast individually, so we don't have time to cover everything, of course. But he did get a lot out of Europe, and I think Paris, especially, and which I believe Saint Petersburg is kind of modeled a little bit after. So let's talk about the next big thing that happens, which is, of course, another Swedish king that will be his bitterest enemy, named Charles XII, who became a power, the warrior known as the Warrior King in Scandinavia. And he, of course, the Swedish Empire had colonies in Germany as well at this time, I believe. And he was really the first king to try to invade Russia, wasn't he, Charles XII, that started the Great Nordic War, which was the next big
Yes.
in Peter's life.
Right. Well, there's sort of two things there. One is yeah, I mean, in terms of leading an army in battle personally, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to remember whether during the reign of like Ivan the Terrible or during the time of Troubles, well, I mean, Stefan Batory, the king of Poland, did invade Russia in what was it, 60 in 15, you know, in 15 late 1560s, early 1570s, there were some major sieges and battles. That ended kind of like more or less in a draw because he recovered the lands that Ivan the Terrible was occupying but failed to capture anything new. So there were some precedents for that, but that's like you point out, was a, you know, a long time ago by that point. So I'd say, you know, like Stefan Batory was, I think, the first example of that. But Charles the 12th, yeah, I mean, he indeed wanted to do more than just capture a few cities. He actually decided to march on Moscow. Now the second thing is that he didn't actually start the war. The war, believe it or not, was started by Peter and his allies, because if you remember, when he went on that grand embassy to Europe to try to raise an alliance to fight the Turks, actually nobody was interested in fighting the Turks anymore. However, there were a lot of volunteers to take on the Swedes, who at that point, ironically, and I'm not a Swedish historian, but my understanding is that Sweden had been in a bit of a decline by that time for quite some time,
And we should mention as well that No Power really liked Sweden very much. But they were, it
Exactly.
was if it was a TV show, it would be Everybody Hates Sweden, pretty much.
Yes,
Yeah,
right, so
and we
exactly.
should mention as well, and though it wasn't a very useful alliance, that though it's an unlikely alliance, that Sweden actually had an alliance with the Ottoman Empire, who Peter wanted to fight against.
Yes, absolutely, right. So, I mean, historically, by that point, the Ottoman Empire was allied or at least partnered with France, right? And the French were essentially, they were, bankrolling the Swedes. They were, paying for the Swedish army, giving a lot of subsidies. So it was like this kind of bigger European politics that we see at play. But yeah, so Sweden's neighbors, the Poles hate the Swedes because the Swedes invaded the Poles earlier and kind of like trashed the whole country. The Danes obviously hate the Swedes because the Danes used to be the big boys in the Baltic region until they were displaced by the Swedes. So and then Peter the Great wants his access to the Baltic back. So it was a pretty not much a no-brainer to put together a coalition. And the Swedes, they were on the one hand like they were weak enough that all these people thought, "Ha, now we can take on Sweden." On the other hand, there was this like last one big surge. So like Charles Carl the 11th was like try to
12th.
kind of no what I'm saying his
All right.
predecessor
All right, yeah.
try to rebuild Swedish power, and that's what Carl the 12th inherited. So that in other words, everybody resents the Sweden. They think they can take it on, but they also are a little scared that it's going to come back and rebuild its power. And so they all basically ganged up against the Swedes and attacked from various directions.
Now, we should also mention as well that the Polish Lithuanian Commonwealth, of course, people were interested in having their influence whenever elections for a Polish king was. And Russia, of course, at this time did have a little influence over Poland. So, but even Charles XII, that when he under his invasion, he managed to put a king on the Polish throne, at least for a brief moment, on that is on the Swedish side, or for even for a little while.
Yeah, so that's actually also a very great point because the first few years of the Great Northern War that began in 1700, that it went very, very badly for the Russians, as we know, right? So basically, Charles the 12th, first he defeats the Danes like momentarily, very quickly, with English help, of course, English and Dutch help, but then he quickly moves and defeats the Russians. But he really thinks that the Poles are the main danger. And so his main effort is in Poland. And then he goes and defeats the Poles and their allies, Saxons, because Saxonia was kind of had a personal union, right? So in other words, the sort of Grand Elector of Saxony was also the King of Poland, all right, Augustus. August, I guess, as we call it. So this is kind of like frenzy of military action, and Charles indeed kind of deposes the existing king of Poland for a while, and then that sort of like the real struggle with the Russians begins because Peter the Great assembled another army, moved it to what today is Belarus. There were several battles that again went very badly for the Russians. And that's when Charles decided, you know what? Maybe I can actually take out Peter the Great completely. And he started his doomed march into the interior of the Tsarist Empire.
And of course, one of the most famous that I believe still are celebrated widely today is, of course, the Battle of Poltava, which was decisive victory for Peter the Great in the Nordic War.
Yes, and then so the question, of course, is how if you decide to march on Moscow, which is typically a very, I mean, it's not impossible, obviously, but it's a very difficult enterprise in any historical age. So like, why, how in the world do you end up in Poltava, which is, a smallish city to the, basically to the east of Kiev? So how in the world do you end up there? And the answer to that is that the Swedes made this kind of pact with those Ukrainian Cossacks who were unhappy under the Russian rule. That included the Hetman Mazepa, very important character, who was, very close to Peter the Great, was, one of his top confidants, you know, even his friend, some people would say. And this is really why, sort of like in later Russian history, this was considered to be like one of the most infamous examples of, you know, of high treason. It was not just because like somebody revolted against the Tsar, you know, that happened all the time, but because Peter thought like he could completely trust Mazeppa, that like Mazeppa was, no, he had his back basically, because they had that personal relationship that was, you know, pretty long standing. But in any case, so the Swedes thought that these Cossacks would revolt and provide them with extra military force, and then they can, you know, take out Peter's capital. So that kind of was the premise. However, as other invaders would find out, you know, including Napoleon and Hitler, the logistics is kind of the most important issue when invading that part of Eurasia, and that was hard enough in the 20th century with, you know, trucks and railroads and airplanes, and it was really difficult in the 18th century. And so basically, Charles's army just kind of melted away gradually until it had, you know, a pretty small core of, you know, very good fighters, but there were few of them, and they lost pretty much the entire artillery. They actually, that Ukrainian support that they were promised didn't actually materialize. Only Mazeppa, with a few thousand Cossacks, joined him in that battle. Moreover, Peter intercepted and destroyed like a major supply convoy that was sent from, you know, from Poland, or, you know, across that part of the world to join and resupply Charles. So the Russian cavalry, you know, surrounded and destroyed that convoy. And so at Poltava, it was almost like, you know, a slaughter of the innocents in a sense, because this what was left of the Swedish army was, you know, they were good fighters, but there were so few of them, they were so tired, they were so badly supplied, they were just kind of they were basically wiped out. If that's kind of to make the long story short.
And of course, later Charles XII would try to invade Norway in a film, but he would end up being shot at Fredrik Sten's fortress.
Yes.
So it's his life did end in a tragedy. And it's not so I'm not sure if he would have won the battle if he had survived, but he did end up getting shot near
Right.
Fredrik Sten. But of course, we
Yes.
have to move on, and we still are Peter Brady almost an hour in. So let's talk about the next big thing, which is founding of St. Petersburg, as we mentioned earlier.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, what I probably want to say, and this just kind of like is going to warm us up, and just let me know where you want to take this.
Yeah.
But there is a myth, probably the biggest myth about the founding of Petersburg that still exists in Russia and definitely in Europe, that it was basically just a bunch of uninhabitable swamps and forests. You know, like nobody lived there, right? Horrible climate and empty land, and Peter the Great brought, you know, hundreds of thousands of slave laborers who just built him this majestic city out of nowhere. And that's really, I mean, it's highly misleading in every possible way. Well, first of all, one way in which it's true is that the place that Peter chose to build a city was a very bad, I mean, it was a very bad location. There was like literally half a mile up the river Neva, on which St. Petersburg sits, there was a small Swedish town called Nyenshans. And Nyenshans was, you know, a perfectly nice and comfortable little town with, you know, markets and churches and forts and things like that. There were farms, there were estates that, you know, most of them belonged to various Swedish nobles. There were trading communities. There, so there had been reasonably comfortable human habitation there for, you know, as long as they've been, you know, there's been any kind of organized life in that part of the world. And before the Swedes, there were the Russians, so-called Ijorians, the sort of a particular kind of group that was allied with Novgorod, the Northern Empire. So in other words, like there was life, there was civilization, there was farming. It's just the problem was that Peter the Great built his town in the one spot where he really shouldn't build a city, like the one spot that got completely flooded every few years. But they literally took Nyenshans apart and basically built a city just a little bit down the river. That's what they did.
You mentioned flooding, and of course we will mention this in the next episode when we come to Alexander First. And
Yeah.
one of the things that is what I want to mention now as well is that when it comes to the flooding, is that it was would become a myth that there was a bad omen, so especially under Alexander I, I believe there were some floodings that meant it felt like he was bad luck or something, I think, as the story goes under him as well. So as we will see in the next episode, flooding would become a problem for St. Petersburg later on in its history as well.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's true. That's going to be kind of a big part of the imperial later imperial myth, but even in the Soviet myth, because there was another great flood in 1924, the year Lenin died, right? But going back to Peter the Great, so in retrospect, you know, it's not particularly surprising, and it's a little surprising that he wanted to make that city, you know, that important. But the idea of building a capital, first of all, on the outskirts of your empire, you know, it was pretty normal. Actually, it was pretty normal. Look back at the, you know, say, I don't know, late Roman Empire, right? So where was the capital of the late Roman Empire? It was in what today is Milan, right? And later on in this other town, Ravenna, basically right next to where the barbarian invasions are coming from. So it was a very normal thing. In terms of the Northern Europe, the idea of building your city in the middle of this kind of swampy area, well, it was okay. Stockholm was in a similar circumstances, you know, what today is Helsinki, was in the similar circumstances. Copenhagen, definitely, right? Highly unhealthy places, full of malaria and other diseases like that. So it's really the idea of sort of security and having easy access to communications, you know, was much more important than the fact that, you know, your population is going to die out of cholera every now and then, right? So he did this, and it was a very cleverly chosen area, you know, before we have those 21st century, you know, cruise missiles. You know, it was pretty much impossible to inflict any serious military damage on you know, on that sort of that outpost of Russian power. If you look at the map, right, it's, you know, surrounded by very thick forests, so it was actually a very cleverly chosen location. But even from the sea, it was extremely difficult to invade, just because navigating the Gulf of Finland was so difficult. And it's even more difficult now, of course, when the ships are bigger. So it was basically an area pretty much immune to invasion, and an area if you staged an army and a navy, you could basically threaten all the Baltic. So it was very, you know, very, very strategic. But there's more than the strategy that went into it, and it's this sort of emotional, sort of symbolic project of building this kind of paradise city, sort of the special pet, kind of like pet, or kind of activity that Peter was engaged with. I think that's kind of like what building Petersburg was also very much about. It was not the first city that he built from scratch, though, and that's kind of funny too. The very first one was the town of Taganrog on the Sea of Azov, which, you know, has been in a lot of headlines recently. So this kind of notion that we're going to build a city on some kind of with some kind of sea access, and it's going to be a special example of city building, you know, special. You're going to reorganize your life. Are you going to bring in people from other parts of your empire? You know, that was very much sort of a way of thinking at that time.
Now I want to take a second to talk about his love life as well, because of course first he does get married early on, but it's not a happy marriage. But they do produce one son whom I want to focus a little bit on, which is Peter the Second, or Alexei Petrovich, who would become rather a disappointment. And he, of course, you can kind of understand him, Peter the Second, as well, if you will call him that, because now, growing up with a father such as Peter the Great, it's gonna be a lot of expectations for you, and it doesn't seem especially bright himself as a son, and he didn't really seem to be interested in learning. So, and it's a rather a tragic story, I think, because he does try to escape from his father as well, and he would almost end up in the execution of, or what people say is the execution by Peter the Great. So let's talk.
That's what it seems like. That's what it happened. My colleague here at Yale, Paul Bushkovich, has written probably the best study of Peter the Great that exists out there, and he has a sort of detailed history of the Alexei affair. So yes, indeed. So Peter had basically, you know, he had a sequence of lovers. But the most important thing to remember about sort of sex life of emperors and empresses, which, popular histories, even not excellent popular histories like that of Montefiore, they spend a lot of efforts on. Really important to remember that for people like Peter the Great, sex was not just sex, right? So in other words, like who you're, it's not just the dynastic reasons of who you're married to and who you're allied to, but also what kind of public image you want to project, what kind of lessons you're going to teach to your subjects. And it's very, very, very important. And so the Peter's first wife, Natalia Lopukhina, was was just part of the old Muscovite nobility, and that was kind of like the real foundation of Peter's power. But no, that alliance, didn't work out very well, as we all know. And so Peter's second wife was, and then people are still sort of Catherine the First, as she would become known after his death. People are not like completely sure about her background. It seems like she was from what today is Estonia, most likely a prisoner of war. Most likely she was, enslaved and kept as a basically as a mistress for by Peter's kind of favorite statesman Menshikov. And then Peter decided to take her over and marry her. This whole idea of the Tsar, this kind of God given monarch of this vast Eurasian empire, Mary is this essentially just kind of a complete nobody, right? Who's not even a Russian. It was kind of a big deal. And kind of project a certain image of of your emperor, your Tsar, kind of imposing his will on his subject, but also on his subjects, but also just kind of like demonstrating his sort of engagement with his new subjects, right, with these newly won provinces.
Now, there is some debate because, as you mentioned, she came from a lower background. She was a slave, essentially. And there is some debate because, she didn't really have much choice in the matter, really, when she met Peter the Great. So, is it was there is some debate whether she loved him or not? Do you think that she actually did, that she just more or less pretended to love him? Do you agree with this, that she just did it to for her own survival or for her own benefits, to put it that way?
Right. Well, I mean, it's kind of a difficult question without, asking her. I mean, I think we have to sort of assume pretty safely that she would rather not be enslaved by the invading army. But also there is, there's some evidence. So the way I understand it is that at least, she had a pretty decent relation with Peter the Great, especially, because it wasn't just something, an alliance that, would last a year or two, and then he would move on to different mistresses, right? It was a very much, I'm trying to remember exactly what year that they got together, but like by the time of the Battle of Poltava, and that kind of time period, 1708, 1709, like they had children together by that time. So it wasn't a very, very long relationship, and they were still married when Peter the Great died. Even though, of course, there were all these scandals, right? Supposedly she had an affair with one of Peter's officers, but nonetheless, it seems like,
I mean, he had several affairs, even with mistresses that she picked herself for him. So he did have several affairs himself,
of
to be fair.
course,
But of
of
course,
course,
because he's a man, it didn't really
yeah.
matter as much as when she had an affair.
Absolutely. And for all of the Romanovs, at least the Romanov women, at least, who had been married, unlike Catherine the Great, for example, that there was this double standard. But that double standard, changed over the centuries. For example, like Alexander the First empress, his wife, Maria Alexandrovna, she supposedly had affairs with men. And that really wasn't, she was never I think her boyfriends had suffered to some extent, but she herself didn't. But we can talk about it next week. But yes, of course, Peter had a very kind of a wild personal life. But the point I'm trying to make, I guess, is that Catherine the First very firmly became not just simply, a sleeping partner, but she was very much part of Peter's establishment. So in other words, she was part of the power structure, and there was a big reason why she was proclaimed the ruler as soon as Peter the Great died. It wasn't just because she was a convenient next candidate, but like because she was firmly kind of involved.
She does rule for a little bit after his death as well, doesn't she? So let's talk about her life after Peter the Death's first death, because we did have a lot to cover as well, as I mentioned. So let's talk about her brief rule. And of course,
Her
what I want to add as well is that Peter also added the Order of Catherine, I believe, which would become
Yes.
an essential medal for, soldiers all the way up to the end of the
Well,
Tsarist era, I believe.
sort of. It wasn't actually for soldiers. It was an order. So the order for soldiers under Peter was known as the Old Order of Saint Andrew. But that's, that will take us too far apart to discuss this. So the Order of Catherine was established when after 1711, when Peter attempted to invade the Ottoman Empire. After he defeated the Swedes, he thought, huh, now I can really, I'm a really great warrior now. And so he thought, okay, now that the Swedes are out of the picture, I'm going to go and invade the Turks. So he invaded, and that didn't really go very well. And the only reason why the Russians were able to get out of that part of the Ottoman Empire they invaded, today known as Moldova, was because they bribed the Turkish general. Or the vizier, I guess, who was leading the Turkish army. And supposedly the legend goes that Catherine, who accompanied Peter in the campaign, and her court ladies donated all the jewelry to basically like provide the bribery funds. And supposedly to repay Catherine for her sacrifice and her basically support, and more about this in a moment. So Peter established that order of Saint Catherine that was until the end of the empire, awarded to basically aristocratic ladies who did, something outstanding, like, amazing charity work or something like that. But it's really actually it's very not a trivial point at all, because even the literature, for example, about early kind of like American exploration, basically early, say like early culture of Atlantic slavery, right? So any kind of part of the world in 16th, 17th, early 18th century where life is very dangerous, there are a lot of illnesses, a lot of diseases, bad climate. Basically, the only way you could have an army in those kind of conditions was like if you had a bunch of basically, women and other kinds of followers who were not armed, who were basically helping the male warriors survive. I'm trying to sort of make a complicated point here, but it's very important. So it wasn't just Catherine was providing moral support. It's like to have these kind of non-combatants with you in the kind of steps of next to the Black Sea, it was a matter of survival. Very important.
So, of course, Catherine rules for a little bit, and of course, her successor is Anna. And that's also that she is rather an understudied part of Romanov history, I think. And of course, so she would, as Montefiore described, it's a while since I read the book now, but of course, as he described Anna, she was rather a cruel person, but she was a competent ruler. And he spoke about wars in the Romanov palace, but she would as well be surrounded by dwarves as well, and she was rather cruel
Absolutely.
to them, I believe, as well. So let's talk about the rule of Anna for a little bit.
Yeah, so like the basic well, a couple of basic things. One is if you just want to get basic flavor for what it was like. People describe it, other historians describe it as a Baroque culture, right? And so, like in case people don't have the immediate understanding of what Baroque is, it's just an artistic and cultural movement in the early 18th century. We have like for example Bach's music, right? Vivaldi. So we have like ornate, beautiful forms, very sort of complicated architecture and painting, but also we have these really sort of strange ideas about entertainment. Right, and having fun that we just discussed earlier. And her world, Anna's world, was still very much this kind of part of the Baroque culture where you assemble curiosities, right? So in terms of her personal life and her intellectual outlook, I mean, yes, she wasn't any kind of big intellectual, let's put it this way. Compared to Peter the Great, who was very not particularly educated, but an intellectual guy in
I'm
some
sorry
way.
for disturbing you again, because as mentioned, we should also mention, I'll go back on it before Anna succession, and that Peter, because of the death of Peter the Second, or Alexei, Peter Alexei, we should mention that Peter had no male heir in succession, and there wasn't really, at this point, women weren't really allowed to rule Russia. So what Peter did was he issued a decree that Anna would be the one to succeed, and that females should, in the rare necessity, of succeed on the throne of Russia, which would be the case
Right.
basically up until Catherine the Second, and we're going to end this episode.
Well, right. Well, I mean, it wasn't. I gotta sort of change that story
Right.
just a tiny bit. So what Peter the Great did is that he basically said that a ruler can designate his own heir, which is kind of, that was the law of succession. But however, he himself died before he was able to designate an heir, right? So basically the sort of, so his wife basically came to the throne because, the Imperial Guard put her on a throne. Peter the Great did have a grandson, Peter the Second, right? However, he was very young in 1725 when Peter the Great died, so they wouldn't put him on the throne. But after Catherine the First died in 1727, that's when Peter the Second became the Tsar. And so he ruled for like 3 more years. And again, I don't remember what he died of, like smallpox, I believe. I believe. He was, again, very, very young. Like, he wasn't exactly promising to be the worst Tsar or the best Tsar. He was okay, but like, he was just a teenager, right? So, and that's when we get to Anna, the whole Anna Ioanovna affair, because again, Peter the Second dies, he's a teenager, obviously doesn't name an heir. So it was really, again, up to the aristocracy to figure out who's going to be the next Tsar. And basically, by that time, there were two options, okay? One option was Peter's daughter, Elizabeth, or Yelizaveta, who would later become the empress after all. But she's one of the candidates. The second candidate is Peter the Great's niece, Anna, who was married to the Duke of Courland in a small area in what today is Latvia, Latvian part of Lithuania, but mostly Latvia. So, living this kind of completely uneventful life, in a small palace, probably a comfortable life, but she would never dream that she would become the Empress of Russia, right? And so these boyars, or rather, I mean, they didn't call themselves boyars
Imagine the
anymore.
reaction coming out, hey, you will be the new Empress of Russia.
Yeah. Yes, that's pretty well documented. However, that offer came with conditions, and I mean conditions, which were basically that Anna's power would be severely limited, that she would make no major decisions. She wouldn't even be able to commission army officers above the rank of, I think, colonel. And definitely, no major reforms of any kind without the agreement of the so-called Privy Council. So, it would be, if that system had stuck, Russia would be run more or less like 18th century England, probably, where basically, the few aristocratic families call the shots. However, there was quite a big reaction back, in Moscow. At that point, the court was hanging out in Moscow. There was a big reaction when people found out. They thought it was basically a coup of sorts by top aristocracy at the expense of, wasn't, had nothing to do with democracy. It was not at the expense of the people. It was at the expense of, small aristocracy, like, your rank and file generals, landowners, officials. So we're talking whether Russia was going to be ruled by, say, top 10 people in the country or by top 500 people in the country. Okay. And so the top 500 people, sort of putting it very, very briefly, they decided they're better off just kind of putting all the official power in Anna's hands so that she could, like, mediate the disputes, and basic kind of these kind of mid-level guys would have more say in the system. So, like, does that make any sense? Because it's kind of like a complicated, some people say, proto-constitutional affair,
Almost almost
where.
constitutional, like you said, it's almost like the same of England becomes almost almost actually was a constitutional monarch.
So, like, but except that she tore up the conditions, When she found out that basically rank and file nobility and the Imperial Guard, they didn't trust the aristocrats, and they didn't want them to be basically so they were, I mean, that's pretty reasonable. If you put yourself in the shoes of somebody living in the 18th century, like, would you rather have to keep happy just one person, one tyrant, or a dozen tyrants? That was a no-brainer. Like, whatever you do, like, would you rather satisfy like a dozen people or just one person who wasn't even, wasn't all that power very hungry from the looks of her? Whereas like Menshikov and Dolgarukov and these kind of families, like, people knew what these people were like. They embezzled on an astronomical scale, and everybody knew exactly how Russia was going to be governed. See what I'm trying to say?
So she, but she doesn't rule with Bavaria. But what I find fascinating about this period is that Elisaveta, or Elizabeth, if for the westernized name, that she did fear for her life essentially in during that period, because there is was talk about that she was going to do a coup d'état against Empress Anna, but she doesn't go through with it. But there was talk that she should do a coup d'état against her.
So this sort of last bit that you said got cut off.
That's Elisaveta was
Oh,
going to
okay.
do a coup d'état against
Sure.
Empress Anna, but she didn't go
Oh
through
yeah.
with it.
So I mean, there were sort of several attempts to sort of to kind of seize power one way or another. There was the so-called Lopukhin affair. So like, there were several aristocratic clans that are kind of trying to rearrange the power structure. Now, look, ultimately, I think you're absolutely right. Anna's reign is understudied. It is clear, as the sort of one historian who looked at it in detail, and they've put it in one sentence, it was really important that those kind of innovations in institutions of Imperial Russia, in the symbols, in the way sort of the court was run, the way aristocrats presented themselves. It was clear after Anna has reigned that, like, there was no going back to, say, the 17th century system. Like, there was no way that Peter's legacy was going to be, discarded. Right? That makes sense. Now, in terms of Elisaveta and being her, being this very kind of a vivacious, right, attractive, lively daughter of Peter the Great. Yes, I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, this kind of myth of like Elisaveta being the daughter, meaning somehow being the guardian of Peter's legacy, that all appeared under Anna, and Anna was highly suspicious of Elisaveta. And whether there would have been a coup against her, I mean, that's not impossible, except that, of course, Anna died of kidney disease before we had a chance to find out.
Now, of course, Anna Elisaveta, she does take over, but she doesn't have, she doesn't, as far as I have a heir either, and that's one of the main concerns during her reign. So how does, of course, Peter the Third come into her, because he's born and raised in Prussia and the other
Yes.
part of Germany. I don't remember if it's Prussia, but I want to go back to Peter the Third as well, because he's rather a tragic story, I think. And you do, when you look at his life, you do understand how he ended up the way that he did. But let's talk about first, let's talk about Elisaveta's reign
Sure.
and her rise to power.
Sure, absolutely. So that whole sequence of palace revolutions, I mean, is known exactly as the era of palace revolutions, where the Imperial Guard that had been originally created by Peter the Great, there were basically a few thousand soldiers, were kind of like this muscle that could remove a ruler from power and replace him. And so
Kind
there's a
of like
whole
the
sequence,
Praetorian Guards of ancient Rome.
sort of, yeah, exactly, right, like the Praetorian Guard. Exactly. That's a very kind of probably the best description of that. And so you had a whole series of these coups, and the one that put Elisaveta on the throne was not even the last one, right? But yes, I mean, basically, the person who was officially that tsar after Anna was an infant, Ivan or Ioan the Sixth. Whose mother was a niece to Anna Ioanovna. So it's like we're talking about like remote, reasonably remote relatives. And so these people Anna's remote relatives, they basically failed to not create enough of a following, whereas I know they were pretty much newcomers to Russia, and Elizaveta had had a lot of friends in the Imperial Guard and in the court, and had a lot of assistance from the French, for example. It's kind of like a well-known diplomatic intrigue. The French ambassador was sort of helping her out very heavily. So she staged pretty much a sort of a classic palace coup. She rose up the Imperial Guard and had the baby Tsar arrested and put in prison, and his father and mother exiled. Very classic. But in terms of Elizaveta's rule, it's again, we only have a couple of sentences to cover it, even though it was super important. But I want you to remember it as the reign during which, enlightenment, it's not just came to Russia for the first time, but that's when enlightenment became entrenched there. So the sort of Russian aristocracy and an educated class, small but very important, got accustomed to reading the latest intellectual bestsellers that were coming out of France, and to a lesser extent from other places in Europe, like whether it's Italy or Scotland. You have the first university, you have the first Academy of Arts. So you have a whole sequence of important statesmen who are promoting, promoting learning, promoting higher culture. So in other words, Russia at that time is starting to acquire something of this like gilded, almost fairy tale kind of look that we typically associate with Imperial Russia, as opposed to this earlier kind of military camp kind of vibe that you get from Peter the Great.
And I do believe that Elisaveta was very fashionable as well. Like she was very insistent that nobody was to wear a prettier dress than her. And when I believe that she does bald at some point as well. And then when she does bald, no one was allowed to have hair as well. So she shaved all the ladies in waiting and lady noble women of the court because if she was bald, no one else. If she wasn't allowed to have hair, no one else were going to have hair as well. So she was a fashionable woman, it's needless to say.
So look, I don't know, to be completely honest, I don't remember the balding story, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was true.
I
The
believe
one
this
thing
was
to
from Robert K. Masson's biography of
okay.
Catherine the Second. I do believe that's where it comes from.
Well, I mean, the thing is that a lot of this writing from that time period specifically, whether it's Elizaveta herself or whether it's the poor Peter the Third that we're going to discuss in a moment, sort of like a lot of the writing comes from the person's enemies, right? And so we have to like take it with a grain of salt. Now, the one sort of important point historically that comes out of this is that rulers, they didn't, just like with Peter the Great, you didn't just take a lover because you felt like taking a lover. You didn't wear a particular dress because you liked fashion. Rather, like everything that these rulers did was this kind of like theatrical performance. It was just kind of like a theater of public life that was meant to project this kind of like splendor and power of the monarchy. That's kind of why they were doing this. So I hope that makes sense. And then, of course, yes, if Elizaveta, since she projected a particular, feminine image, she never pretended she was a warrior, like Catherine did for a little while, or a lawgiver of any kind, she was, almost like she was kind of like the top lady in the court, right? She was very, it was like it was a very feminine image, but it was also the one that projected power. Like, so it's kind of like the best way to describe it. A lot of things we usually associate with later with Catherine the Great and this kind of classical Russian Enlightenment, came because there was the background for that set under Elizaveta, just to put it this way. Probably not just one last quick thing to add. Again, I'll try to fit it in a sentence, is that even though Imperial Russia became part of this tightly knit sort of diplomatic system of Europe that existed in Europe at that time, it was under Elizaveta when Russia's participation in sort of various alliances and so on and wars became kind of like integral, right? So in other words, it wasn't just Russia would sometimes choose to do this and not to do that. Like, well, I could get involved in this war, I could stay aside if I wanted to. So under Elizabeth, it wasn't really an option anymore. Like Russia was just completely enmeshed in this kind of system of relations.
And of course, again, the problem with that with the success, she had needed a succession as well, and she didn't have
Yes.
an heir. So how did she find Peter the Third? Because and I want to bring before we go into it, I want to bring up this mother had a rather tragic story because she the
Yeah.
story goes, I believe, that she was standing outside the window in the cold, and some servants said, "You should close that window. Isn't you're gonna get a cold?" And she says, "I'm a Russian there, I'm used to the cold." But she, in the end, she does end up having a cold, and she dies from fever, I believe, because because she didn't close the window. So the story goes, I believe.
So I don't really remember the specific story of her particular, just how exactly she died. Like, yeah, I mean, something like that, I seem to recall. But what sort of, I think, in terms of succession, what's important to know is that, I mean, she had illegitimate children, right?
I mean, I
But
was talking about Peter the Third's mother, right?
oh, Peter the
Not
Third.
Elizabeth, not Elizabetta,
Well,
but Peter the
oh, you
Third.
said, okay. Okay,
Yeah.
well, in terms of like why she chose Peter the Third is that like she specifically decided not to marry. I mean, that was her decision officially. You know, she had, you know, lovers and so on. But basically Peter the Third was her nephew. He was the grandson of Peter the Great. So Peter the Great had another daughter, Anna, who was married off to a German ruler of Schleswig. Schleswig-Holstein, a tiny German principality that, you know, borders with Denmark. So Anna was married off to its ruler, and so the future Peter III was basically this kind of German princeling who got plucked out of his comfortable North German life and, you know, brought to Petersburg, you know, a few years before Elisaveta's death. And he was basically kind of like groomed to be the heir to the throne, and also provided with a wife, also a German princess, Sophie Augusta Friederike of Anhalt-Zerbst, who was going to be Catherine the Great. And Elisaveta basically, you know, very consciously like prepared and groomed them to take over after her death. So it wasn't some kind of big tragic story of succession. You know, they were. There were years and years and years to sort of educate and prepare these people.
But Peter the Third's life, I think, is rather tragic and is suffering because his mentor was rather cruel to him as well. And he didn't really have a happy upbringing as well, I believe.
Yeah. Yes, but I mean, in the sense that this was, you know, this was still the mid-18th century, and just like our idea of what royal comforts were, don't necessarily, you know, fit the situation. You know, children. Even royal children were bitten, and a lot of people were unhealthy.
I mean, to pick an
Yeah.
example, Frederick the Great was in prison and beaten and I believe tortured by his own father, so not much fatherly love there, to put it that way. And this was the Hanoverians, they hated each other pretty much
Yeah.
as well. So, and it wasn't uncommon in Europe at the time, of course, that they did not go very well along. And of course, in the Ottoman Empire, you had Bayezid the Second, I believe. No, sorry, Selim the First killed is presumably killed his own father, so there wasn't, like you said, it wasn't
Yeah.
uncommon at the time.
Yeah. So, in other words, this kind of scenario that a dynasty, dynastic life, court life is a place of, you know, happiness, tranquility, comfort, like that's supposed to be like the most comfortable place to be in your empire. You know, that's not at all the case in the 18th century. But look, Peter the Third had all the time in the world, and you know, he had years and years to recover from his earlier trauma. One thing I want to point out is that there's a very, you know, very readable, entertaining source of Catherine the Great's, you know, own memoirs, right? That you know, we basically judge Peter the Third and that kind of history of Catherine's coup mostly based on those memoirs. And And since, she had her husband popped off, basically, it's not surprising that he's represented as basically almost like mentally handicapped, kind of juvenile, not serious, not intelligent, basically really a pathetic creature. However, sort of historians who actually looked at things that Peter the Third, said and did and things he was interested in, they get a very different picture. I mean, indeed, he failed to, form sort of a power structure of his own, but, he was a, very well educated, an intelligent person who had some really great reform ideas. To give you only two very small examples, after a long renovation, his tiny palace just outside of St. Petersburg, is now accessible to the public. I visited it a few years ago, and that included, well, they attempted to basically reconstruct his art collection that was housed in that area. Much of it has been lost, of course, but basically, the sort of people who reconstructed the palace, they kind of tried to create the original furnishings to the extent that they could. And basically, yes, Peter the Third had a very keen sense of appreciating contemporary art. He was a very highly cultured person. And so when you get like reading Catherine's memoirs that, Peter was, torturing rats for fun, it's like, even if it was true at all, remember, we're talking about the 18th century. And that's the kind of life where people could collect art, read Voltaire, and then also torture cats on the side. That wasn't really anything extraordinary. And then the sort of a second example, Peter the Third only reigned for like about 6 months, I think. But he had this brilliant idea to basically make a military and state service voluntary, non-mandatory for Russia's elites, which was like a really a sort of a key reform, I would say probably the most important reform after Peter the Great. So in other words, there was this kind of class of landowners, officers, nobles, who until then were required to basically, as long as they were capable of riding a horse, they were required to serve. And then after they became old, they would be like allowed to maybe have an easier job, right? And so Peter the Third came up with this idea of creating this basically kind of like a real, I can almost call it gentry, not quite aristocracy, but a gentry of, private individuals who would be allowed to kind of live on their estates in the countryside and kind of create this kind of like basically new society of private property owners who would govern their peasants, collect art if they felt like it, serve an army during wartime, and so on. So really, really crucial reform.
And of course, we should mention as well that at the time he took access succeeded the throne, I believe they were in a war that they were winning Russia against Prussia, and that
Yes.
it didn't appear not Russia, Prussia. But he, Peter, of course, naturally growing up in Germany, he was a Germanophile, and of course he adored everything in Germany, so he even a portrait. I believe, was it Frederick the Great who was ruling at the time? I
Yes.
don't remember exactly, but he had even a
Yes.
portrait of him, I think. And he made immediately peace. And of course, as we will discuss in the next episode, this did have an impact on both his son Pavel or Paul, if you will, and of course Alexander as well, who made an
Yes.
alliance with Prussia in his rule. So his Germanophile did have an impact on later rulers as well. So let's talk about how we began with peace with Prussia and how this happened.
Yes, absolutely. So this is basically an absolutely correct story. So Russia was indeed, part of Elizaveta's diplomatic revolution, was to get involved in this coalition, known as the Diplomatic Revolution, when Russia became allies with France and Austria, because until then France and Austria were bitter enemies, right? So Russia gets involved in what was known as the Seven Years' War. Also, some people ironically call it World War Zero, just because it was happening like all over the world, right? In India, America, the Caribbean, and of course in Europe. And Russia indeed is successful in the battlefield and, captures Berlin after a couple of years and completely demolishes Peter the Great, Peter, Frederick the Great's army, to the extent that, like Frederick was completely at a loss what he was going to do because he was writing these kind of panicky letters to his family. So Russia is highly successful, but indeed, Peter III, as soon as he came to the throne in sort of the next year after that, and at the very end of 1761, the first thing he does is that he just grants a truce to Frederick the Great without any conditions. And you know, by that time, just so you know, this area known as Eastern Prussia, which you know, Soviet Union would acquire a part of after World War II, but at that point, you know, it was much bigger, right? It basically, you know, pledged allegiance to Elisaveta, and that was kind of like the heartland of the Prussian monarchy. And so, if Elisaveta hadn't died, and because you know it's been under Russian occupation for several years at that point, and all of its nobility was kind of pledged allegiance, so just imagine like there would be like no German Empire, no rise of Prussia, because there would be no Prussia. And that was a very, very likely scenario. However, Peter III was indeed a Prussophile, but so were a lot of people in Europe. As I think, like your previous podcaster pointed out, right? Frederick the Great was a cult figure in Europe at that time for all kinds of reasons, right and wrong. So, in part because of that kind of aura, in part because Peter III, as many rulers do, when you come to the throne, you try to do the opposite of what your predecessor has been doing. So yeah, so he takes Russia out of the war, and this was like literally the salvation to the Prussians, you know, saved their kingdom and ensured that there would be you know, an important you know, an important power. I mean, we can even say that even diplomatically speaking, that may not have been such a horrible idea to actually like preserve a powerful German state in the middle of Europe that would counterbalance, you know, the Austrian influence. Obviously, if the Russians had demolished Prussia, then Austria would be the only big boy in that part of the world, right? And so there would be like an Austrian Empire on steroids, basically. So it would be a very different configuration, right? So maybe Peter III wasn't quite as stupid to take Russia out of that war.
No, I'm sorry to disturb you again, but Pete, what is as well, but when you mentioned the he does create an alliance, I believe, with Prussia, and there's was talk, of course, before he died, that he was going to invade Denmark. As and again, I'm going to point out to the Norwegian historian that I referred to earlier. He mentioned that it's possible that Peter was going to invade Norway because, you know, Russia is bordering to Norway. That is more realistic that it was Norway because it was a part of Denmark, Norway at the time that it was considered. So it was possible that it was an invasion of Norway up in the north of Russia that he was referring to invade is not Denmark necessarily. Do you think, do you agree with this?
You mean, I'm sorry, you mean when
That he,
Charles the.
so, you know, as if you look at the map, of course, Norway
Yes.
borders with Russia in the north,
Yeah,
right?
yeah,
So
yes.
it is before, according to the Norwegian historian, and how he thinks that it was Norway because it was a part of Denmark, Norway still until 1814. That he was going to invade Norway and not Denmark because he's talking
Who was?
about Peter the Third was
Oh,
planning
really?
to invade Nor
Right. Yes.
Denmark. So it was talking about him invading
Okay.
Norway because it was part of, you know, Denmark, Norway at the time.
I see what you're saying. Okay, absolutely. Right. So in other words, so Peter the Third comes from the Schleswig-Holstein dynasty that borders the Danes, and it's actually weaker than Denmark, right? And so what Peter the Third
But they
did is
was
that
under
he
Danish protection at the time, right?
Right. And so what Peter the Third did is that he declared war against Denmark. Yes, absolutely right. Because Denmark was supposedly oppressing his homeland, Schleswig-Holstein. Yes. Now, in terms of whether Peter the Third wanted to send his army to Norway, I'll tell you the truth. I haven't heard about that, but I wouldn't be too surprised. What I do know is that
But I
the
mean, it makes sense, right? Because it's closer to Russia than Denmark. You had to go through the Baltics, right, to get to Denmark and Schleswig-Holstein with the entire army. So it doesn't sound very logical, considering the distance between Russia and Denmark. And
Yeah,
but
no.
Norway and the borders is closer,
Yeah.
right? So it does make sense to me.
I see what you're saying. I'm just from what I know about how 18th century armies operated, I think it was just like physically impossible for a Russian army to invade Norway by land. It's just like, I mean, even in the 20th century warfare in that part of the world, look at most, Germans didn't even cross the border, right? In 1941, right? It was like the only part of
40.
Soviet, just very tiny bits,
Oh,
right?
right,
Like
yeah.
the very, very tiny part. But for the
Oh, yeah,
most
you're
part,
talking
like,
about Barbarossa, right, yeah.
yeah, like, right. So in other words, in the 18th century, it was just mathematically, physically impossible. But I see what you're saying. I mean, I wonder, but they definitely wouldn't do it over land, that's for sure. Because it was just as impossible as, say, invading India in the early 19th century. So, but another thing to remember is that, like, because Peter the Third only ruled for 6 months, like they didn't get very far.
Yeah,
Like, like
needless to say.
they were making plans, but like
Yeah.
it was all academic, basically.
Yeah. But of course, one thing that I have to be talked about as well, because they are, like you said, they are married 9 years before Peter succeeded to the throne. But, we shouldn't talk about succession as, again, succession becoming an important part, because I believe he was sexually incompetent and he wasn't very interested in Catherine as well, though. But I should mention as well that she does seem to be interested in learning Russian, and she does learn Russian fairly quickly and learn the history and learn the Russian culture. She converts to Eastern Orthodoxy, as I saw on the, this is a short story, but because in the end it's desperate, kind of a desperation, that is almost approved, that they go to Catherine and say, "You need to find a lover," and this is so. The first of many lovers, and what is coming into the picture, which is Grigori Orlov, who will become an important part of her life.
Yes, I mean there was a sort of a several men early on in sort of Catherine's sort of early life in Russia. There was also Stanislav Poniatowski, who would be the last king of Poland. So basically, okay. So first of all, like a lot of this is just kind of like a rumor and rhetoric, and I don't want to say hearsay, but not exactly sort of necessarily trustworthy information. In other words, what I'm trying to say, we're never going to know for sure, who Catherine slept or did not sleep with in those early years. What I think is important is, for the first thing, is that you're
And
absolutely 100% correct, is that she tried to like make herself liked by the Russians, to create a power structure, learn Russian tradition. You're absolutely 100% correct on that. In terms of Peter's sexual dysfunction, I mean, I did hear something like that too, that he had this condition, I think known as phimosis, that needed to be corrected surgically. Basically, uncircumcised guys are known to have that. On the other hand, he's known to have had a mistress, Vorontsova. That was also, so at least whatever condition he had earlier was corrected by the time he was killed. And again, taking a lover was a political act in the 18th century, right? So he took Vorontsova from an old Muscovite nobility to kind of counteract Catherine, who was an upstart, German princess without any rights to the throne, right? So he took Vorontsova to kind of stick it to his wife, right? Basically.
And I think we should mention as well that when Catherine didn't have an heir, it was dangerous for her to be in Russia because she would could be deposed, thrown out, or she, it was dangerous if she didn't get a son or a successor for the throne, right?
Absolutely. But and so there were all these rumors that Catherine's legal son Paul was not actually the product of her official marriage.
So
Now look.
technically, if you look at it, if it really was Orlov who was the father, which I think it's kind of makes sense, right? It's technically the dynasty ended with Peter the Third and the
So,
succession,
if
right?
you believe the story, Erland, if you believe the story, but I know that there are many, many portraits of Paul, and on every one of those portraits, he looks very similar to Peter the Third. So, like the family resemblance is, unmistakable. So, unless all of those portraits were doctored, but there were a lot of pictures, right? So, presumably, at least like one of them would be. Would tell the truth. Like it would be difficult to doctor every single portrait. Or at least like somebody would say, look, every single portrait of Tsar Paul was, changed to make him look more like his father. Like somebody would have said something like this. So in other words, like this kind of graphic evidence suggests that Tsar Paul looked very much like his alleged father, his official father, right? So now in terms of so whether so what was the biological truth? I couldn't tell you, but that's what we do know.
So, of course, let's have a talk about the disposal of Peter the Third. And like you said, is the blood in Judith, or is it pretty much bloodless when she decides that she is going to, this is not going to end well for Russia. We need to do something, and I need to be the new head of state.
So the very first part of your sentence got clipped off. But it sounds like you're asking how Catherine decided to.
What she was, well, how did she decide that enough is enough, I need to do something, and I'm going to become the new head of state? How did it come to this? And did she have, she must seem to have some support among the boyars and
Oh, yes.
the aristocrats, right? So if she, since she successfully pulled this off.
Yeah, I mean, so they're by the way, they weren't known as boyars at that point, but they were descendants of the old boyar families who would now speak French and, wear nice French fashions. But yeah, like their families were the old boyar families. She did, in fact, had all the good reason to expect that Peter the Third would, get rid of her somehow, and, replace her with his girlfriend Vorontsova. Their relations were clearly not good at all by that time, by the middle of 1762. And it's also clear that Catherine had been planning a move for a very long time, that there were, officers in the Imperial Guard that were, aware of what was happening. And by the way, just so you know, the Imperial Guard itself, it's sort of top officers were from old and powerful families, but the kind of rank and file, they were still old families, but they were not like super wealthy. They were just kind of like this sort of conservative backbone of the monarchy. They were guys who are like, yes, I can trace my family to the 15th century, but I don't have very much. My wallet is not as big as my name, let's put it this way. So like all these officers had a lot to gain, had their patron Catherine, gained the throne. So there's a plan. Also, there's foreign diplomacy. Basically, kind of Europe is famous for that because finally every European capital has a diplomatic corps, ambassadors from all kinds of countries, and they are actively involved in spying and plotting and bribing each other. And so there was, the French were particularly active. But the French, the Austrians, the English, they're all basically like trying to see how this configuration of power was going to go in Russia, and the French ambassador, again, is particularly active there. So there is quite a movement, an organized movement against Tsar Peter, and obviously, it was difficult to keep a secret like that at that time. So, kind of everybody knows that something is in the air, and probably the last thing that Tsar Peter should have done was to alienate the Imperial Guard by telling them, oh, yes, so you were fighting the Prussians and almost winning, or actually winning, and now you have to go on a march in Denmark, right? So it's kind of like the last thing you want to do. So he basically failed to create this kind of base of support, sort of like a group of well-placed nobles who were just kind of looking out for his interests. I mean, he tried to, again, he's. There was a group of officials like the Vorontsov family and several others like it, like the Panin family. There was a group of officials that Peter was working with, but like he wasn't as good at it as his wife. Like, to make it short, basically.
So, arguably, one of the biggest things to happen during Catherine's second reign, and again, to put it, in context of what Putin says when he invaded Crimea in 2014, is that it historically belongs to Russia, which is really not that long. It belonged to Russia historically, because it's just until Catherine the Se from Catherine the Second, which is just 250 years ago, that it has belonged historically, quote unquote, for Russia. So it's let's talk about one of the biggest things under Catherine, I would
Yes.
say, is of course the invasion of Crimea. And before this, I want to go back a little bit. Let's talk about the state of the Crimean Khanate, which it was called at the time, which was under Ottoman suzerainty. So let's talk a little bit, just quickly, about Crimea before the invasion of Catherine II.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's if Catherine the Great hadn't taken over and destroyed the Crimean Tatar state, you know, it had all the like there was sort of like all the indications that it would become like another sort of smallish kind of European, quasi-European state. Because I mean, Crimean Tatars kind of went through various transformations, various phases in their long history. Crimean Khanate appeared in the early 15th century and was actually originally an ally to the Muscovites, because the Muscovites and the Crimeans, they basically made an alliance to fight off the other Tatars, especially descendants of the Golden Horde. However, for all the 16th and part of the 17th century, Crimean Tatars, they were basically like raiders and slave takers. And there's a lot of literature on the Mediterranean slave culture, and the Crimean Tatars essentially provided the Ottomans with slaves, with enslaved people. At the same time, it wasn't just kind of like a uniform structure, because on the one hand, you had these trading cities that were under direct rule of the Ottomans. On the other hand, you had these kind of like old Crimeans, so to say, who were living in the Crimean Peninsula. Some of them were engaged mostly in the trade, you know, some of them did a bit of fighting, but basically it was a sedentary society, you know, with towns and crafts and so on. And then finally, there was this kind of like the outskirts of this kind of Crimean domain, some of them in the northern, sort of, half of the peninsula that's very dry, very flat. And some of them lived in this area that where the fighting is taking place right now in that part of Ukraine, just north of Crimea. And these were basically more impoverished, but also warlike, very good warriors, and very sort of kind of happy to like raid and plunder their neighbors, kind of groups, that were later known as the Nogay, Nogay, Nogay Tatars. So essentially, when the Russians took over that part of the Black Sea steppe, the Nogai got deported to sort of further east, essentially, and they're still living there, basically. But basically, yeah. So like you have these different groups. You know, some of them are sedentary, some of them are nomadic. But overall, Crimean Tatars were, you know, they were excellent warriors. In this kind of early modern world, they moved a lot quicker than any of their enemies, and they could provide a very large army that would appear out of nowhere, basically demolish a particular region and, you know, go back with all the plunder. And so there was a lot of bad blood between the Russians and the Crimeans for many, many centuries. Crimeans plundered Moscow a couple of times, plundered a lot of other major locations in the early Muscovite state. But by the time you get to the 18th century, European style armies with, you know, muskets and discipline and cannon basically made Crimean way of doing things no longer feasible, basically. Right. And so the Russians fought a couple of wars against the Ottomans under Catherine the Great. And as a byproduct of those wars, they captured Crimea and officially annexed it in 1783. That's kind of like a basic story. We can
Now,
elaborate on that if you want.
unfortunately, I don't think we have time, but there is something I want to mention as well before we go to the next thing, big thing in Catherine's life. But there is this story that now, do we know where it originated, that she fooled around with a horse? That because there is this some rather amusing story that she did have a sexual or affection with a horse at some point.
Right. Okay. So that's a very famous story. And like pretty much whenever Catherine the Great comes up in this kind of American context, somebody asks about it. I mean, I personally like don't think that, and I don't think like Any serious historian thinks that she actually had intercourse with a horse. So I think this was just mostly British propaganda, basically. She had a little bit of an issue with Great Britain during the American Revolt towards the end of her reign. And so there's a lot of this kind of anti-Russian propaganda that started to come out in the 1770s and 1780s. Basically, what some historians of the Enlightenment call political pornography was, they, if you think that this is crazy, what they wrote about Catherine the Great, things they wrote about Marie Antoinette were even worse. So it's kind of like a very typical 18th century product, honestly. Nothing really surprising. But the big point to make here, though, is that popular histories of Catherine, like including one by Macy. No, they tend to just focus on Catherine look as a woman, as if she was a 20th century woman, right? So I think that book is even called, right, Portrait of a Woman. So basically, yes, yeah, she was this like lonely individual on the throne, and she just like needed somebody to basically kind of work through her stress, right? And kind of keep her just a little bit happy and less lonely. And I think a more accurate description of what he was doing is that Catherine was very self-disciplined. She was, again, like, we have to forget about English propaganda and look at who she really was. She was highly intellectual, super disciplined. She and every single thing that she did for a purpose, including taking all these lovers. And obviously there's a lot of exaggeration there, but it's clear that the earlier ones like Orlov or Potemkin, no, they were basically her partners. She was even married to Potemkin illicitly. So they were clearly her partners, whereas later on, when she became older and the lovers became younger, it was more of like a political gesture. So these young guys were supposed to be like the paragons of virtue. Like she was the lawgiver, she was the ruler who changed her society to make it, more orderly, more prosperous, right? Sort of more comfortable to live in. And these guys, these young guys who kind of were molded under her influence, there were these kind of examples of what Russia's upper class was supposed to be like. Like, does that hope that comes across? So she was doing everything she was doing was not because she was a lonely woman, even though she probably was, but she was doing this for political reasons,
Well,
primarily.
let's talk about the lovers for a second. We're going to go into Potemkin in a second, but let's because so even though you were a lover of Catherine the Great, even as you got older, it can be quite exhausting as well. Even though you were rewarded quite well, according to Massey at least, it could be very exhausting, though even though you could advance quite far in a court or in military advances when you were a lover of Catherine.
Yes, and I mean these young men basically became at least the successful ones became incorporated into sort of the very top echelon of the sort of power structure in St. Petersburg. And I'll be completely like, if you told me to like rattle off the names of every single of those so-called favorites, I know I wouldn't be able to do it. But probably
Who can?
among but probably among the sort of the later batch, the most famous one was Zubov, Platon Zubov, Z Ubov, who and his descendants as well like became like very a very important family in the 19th century. They got married with a bunch of important families and so on. So yeah, I mean it's was definitely, it was definitely a way for somebody from a middling nobility to just suddenly gain everything, right? Somebody like, basically, somebody who owned and served peasants at that time, you basically had to own at least 100 to be able to like live like a normal person, like the other upper class guys. And so, like, imagine if it's somebody who's just basically making ends meet, like you have to serve in Petersburg and buy expensive uniforms, and your peasants, sometimes pay their dues, sometimes they don't. Like all of a sudden, like you have everything, villages with thousands of serfs, and all the generals are flattering you. So it's quite like it's kind of like the change of fortune that Catherine's reign was famous for.
So, of course, one of the most famous, imagine one of them, but arguably one of the most famous, and Montefiore wrote a book about the relationship as well, which I highly recommend, is of course Potemkin. And well, of course, so that's how did he come into Catherine's life? And he would be, well, he has mentioned that he allegedly married, but there is still some debate about did he really marry Catherine or did he not marry Catherine? Was it? I think most historians seem to confirm that there was a marriage alliance there. So let's talk about the relationship of Catherine and Potemkin.
Yes, I mean, I was looking up a Russian biography quite a while ago, actually. But I do remember that, like, people who try to look at, like, church records and things like that, like, it seems like there was a church, a secret marriage, a secret religious ceremony between Potemkin and Catherine the Great, even though, of course, like I said, it was never made public. In terms of Potemkin, it's one of those just most amazing figures from her era, one of those kind of like Enlightenment era statesmen. Even though he did come from a very kind of nondescript kind of lower gentry family, and his ascent was based completely on his support for Catherine's coup, or even like not so much of Catherine's coup as his friendship with the Orlov brothers who were, Catherine's primary supporters, right? And there were like five of them. Yeah, it's good that you mentioned that book by Montefiore. It is his book on Potemkin is very highly regarded and definitely a recommended reading. But Potemkin was this sort of extremely talented administrator. So even after his personal relationship with Catherine, like he wasn't living with her anymore, but he was kind of the driving force behind this whole colonization project in the south area that's became known as the New Russia, Novorossiya, which again, like I said, when the this whole that when the Ukrainian events began around 2013, 2014, that's when the term kind of got resurrected. But New Russia basically meant territories to the south and the southeast of this kind of Ukrainian core territory. So basically, like what was historical heartland of the Ukrainian Cossack lands, basically, if you look at the map of Ukraine today, that would be just basically the north, the very sort of north, Kiev, Poltava, and Chernihiv, the three provinces, and everything else was basically under either under still under Polish rule, or everything to the south or to the east was under Nogai Tatars, basically. No, there's some nuances there that I'm going to skip for now. But essentially, yes, so the Russians under Potemkin and several generals led a series of military campaigns that also involved the navy sailing all the way around Europe and basically attacking the Ottomans from the Mediterranean side. There were these two wars, and the idea was to basically, when they say New Russia, it wasn't just, like, oh, it's a cute name. They actually meant to sort of have a new economic and power center. And the capital city of that is, well, today it's known as Dnipro. In the Soviet days, it was Dnipropetrovsk, one of the largest industrial centers in Soviet Ukraine. And under the emperors, it was known as Yekaterinoslav, meaning glory to Yekaterina. So it Potemkin wanted to make it the new capital of the Russian Empire. And so for decades afterwards, you had this like really tiny town with this gigantic cathedral because like they built the city center but didn't have time to build the rest.
Now, of course, another thing that is, of course, what that was a line designed to be against the Ottomans is, of course, the Habsburg-Warsaw alliance that was formed under Potemkin and Joseph II. And of course, this is another, you mentioned one, the King of Poland as well, and he becomes kind of essential here as well, I think, because he is, helps to form the alliance. So let's talk about how the Russo-Habsburg alliance with Joseph II got started. Joseph, and again, this is where we get the famous Potemkin scheme, where he supposedly arranged several fake cities all around Russia to impress Joseph II's envoys.
Right.
And, of course, Odessa was formed as well as a modern town. So, I mean, I believe it was a small settlement, but really, under Potemkin, it became central part and it still is an important city today. So, let's talk about the Russo-Habsburg, sorry,
That's
yes, and the Russo-Habsburg alliance.
of course, and it sounds like you're writing about yours, reading about Joseph the Second right now, right? So,
Yes, yeah.
yes. So, well, I mean, to begin with, actually, it's this kind of partnership between the Russians and the Habsburgs actually like went way, way, way back into the early 16th century, even. But it wasn't the same as like you fighting the wars together side by side, which is what was happening in the 18th century. So yeah, so I mean that was a very kind of long, 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 long-standing sort of idea that basically the Russians and the Austrians would fight together, against the Ottomans as their common enemy, but also they would gang up to keep, the Poles and basically the Northern Europeans in check. So that was true. But also the first half of the 18th century, it was this t weird time period when the Ottoman Empire, it was clearly not a spring chicken anymore, right? So in other words, militarily, it just wasn't performing as well anymore, but it wasn't quite as obvious yet, right? So in other words, it was still able to put together very large armies, it had, a lot of revenue. It was ruling as sort of the still a vast European empire, so and even to the point when the Ottomans were still kind of claiming, trying to retain certain portions of what like even today is Ukraine, for example, the Podolian province. It's like basically in southwest of Ukraine, just to the north of where Odessa is. So in other words, like there's still a very sort of important military confrontation. And even though the Russians are starting to gain the upper hand, it was a lot easier to fight those kind of wars with allies, basically. It's still, remember, this is still 18th century. This is basically before there is such a thing as canned food or understanding that, like, you need fresh water. That's at least that's not contaminated. If you don't want your army to just die out, like I'm just trying to like explain it very kind of a plain terms in the sense that 18th, early 19th century, you start your campaign with, I don't know, 20,000 soldiers, and a few weeks later you're only going to have 5,000 because it's just like the conditions were just like so appalling and dangerous that. Just being, part of a European army with modern weapons, just like it was not enough yet. So Catherine the Great and Potemkin did in fact form that alliance. And in terms of the story of how Joseph visited these newly acquired Russian provinces, like there are sort of a couple of things there. One is, again, this is how 18th century operated. So, like, of course, you would be expected to put together some nice decorations, right? So, like, yeah, I mean, of course, that's what you were expected to do. That's you stage, fireworks and build mock villages, and that's how people functioned. And it's also true that, of course, this prosperity just wasn't there yet. So Catherine invited colonists from, Germany, from basically all over Europe. There were Serbs and Albanians and Greeks and Italians, lots of Germans who just invited to come and settle. The Russian peasants were moved as well from the north and Ukrainian peasants. But at the same time, it would be really the 19th century one that would take off. That's what I'm trying to say. But listen, but also the, the ships that were in the harbor that the Austrian Emperor saw, like they were real ships. So in other words, like the first thing they did was to build a powerful Black Sea Navy that put the Ottomans out of action in a series of battles. So like some of it was true, some of it wasn't, but the navy was real, and the army was real as well. So I don't know if that's.
Something else I want to talk about is, of course, and this was quite common in 18th century Europe as well, is that smallpox was ravaging the continent, and of course, not just the continent, but then the entire world at the time. And one of the things Catherine did was that she was pro-vaccinations. She helped out with vaccinations. And let's talk about small. There's a few things left I want to talk about before we're going to end this episode. And one of them
Sure.
is the smallpox epidemic in Russia and how Catherine helps to help, maybe not stop it, but she did help. She didn't stand much help vaccinate quite a lot of people, I think, from smallpox.
Yes, well, Erland, I have to say, like, in the history of public health, I just know that it's important, but it's not exactly, you know, my specialty, what I researched. I mean,
No
yes, I mean, it's
problem.
generally the knowledge that she indeed led the vaccination campaign that was very important. It is well known that there was a plague revolt in 1771 and a plague epidemic that was kind of a big issue, and that these kind of events basically created a lot of tension, a lot of pressure on the government, and a lot of motivation to basically, like, reform and reorganize various government structures. Because and there were other examples too, like there was a massive revolt by Cossacks and sort of other groups under Pugachev in the 1773, 75, again, a major event, because the Pugachev claimed to be Catherine's dead husband, right? As everybody.
I wanted to talk about that as well.
So like, you know, just an important thing to remember is that, like, epidemics and the Pugachev uprising, they basically terrified the upper classes. Like, even several generations later, in the early 19th century, like, people still remembered it, basically, how, like, they almost died, or, like, how they had to hide in the toilet because, you know, like, the Cossacks invaded and, like, they were going to kill them. Essentially, it's the revolt was a kind of a borderland issue. You know, there were Cossack groups in the Ural Mountains who felt they were being, you know, basically mistreated by the central government, which is true. There was a host of other issues. There were various non-Russian groups that, like the Bashkirs, who thought they were, you know, being mistreated by imperial authorities. Cossacks were also persecuted on religious grounds because they were all believers. You know, there were many, many Cossack revolts. It's just this one was really well organized. Cossacks were at that point still, you know, like, they were the real deal, you know, very powerfully, the well-trained, powerful warrior system. The scary thing about it is that it wasn't just, they didn't just limit themselves to hanging out in the borderlands, you know, in the Urals and in what today is the north of Kazakhstan. And they actually tried to march into the central Russia and try to, like, you know, get the peasants to revolt. And that's what really scared the ruling classes.
Something
And
that we
but
have, I'm sorry for this interrupting you again, but something that, as well as part of this in the fake Peter the Third revolt is that, of course, as you mentioned, peasants were kind of seem to be kind of pro on his side. And what we haven't talked about as well is that, you know, Russia was basically a land of serfdom still, though it had been abolished in several parts of Europe at this point. Russia was still heavily influenced by, not influenced, but it was heavily populated by serfs. And, you know, Catherine, I believe she was playing with the idea of abolishing serfdom, but when this revolt happened, she was like, they revolted against me. Why should I do anything for them in return? So she was, I believe she was playing with the idea of abolishing, which of course wouldn't happen until Alexander II, which we are going to talk about
Yeah.
next week. But you know, it's she did play with the idea, I think, of abolishing the serfdom. But when the Cossack revolt happened with the fake Peter the Third, she realized that if they are against me, then I'm not gonna liberate them if they won't, you know, go against me.
Well, Ireland, I mean, to be completely honest, I'm not positive that this is exactly why she failed to abolish serfdom. I do agree with you that it probably would have been a really good idea to do it at that point, right? Just because when Catherine came to power, like I said, her husband, Peter III, basically emancipated the service class, and Catherine confirmed that it would be really logical that because now the nobles don't need the labor of the serfs to carry out their mandatory service. So now you should just, you know, emancipate the peasants. And there were, of course, many, many ways to, you know, keep the peasants under control. Right. So in terms of why she didn't do it, I mean, the historians are still arguing about part of it, probably that she had her hands full anyway. Another, there were a lot of wars and various activities happening.
I mean,
Another
my
thing.
argument seems is I believe that this was Robert K. Massey's words, that she meant that when they revolted, why should she do anything for them in return when they were against her? I do believe this is what Massey seemed to think.
No, I mean, I don't think that's a very strong argument, to tell you the truth. So I think there were sort of, and with a solution like that, with a big issue like that, there's not going to be one sort of simple reason. And Catherine was not a kind of stateswoman, statesperson who would be thinking in those kind of terms. How do we know? Because a lot of her drafts and writings and letters and memos have survived, and she was thinking very much ahead, and she was a strategizing, careful, administrator and politician. So like, there isn't. I don't think that's why she failed to abolish serfdom. I think she failed to abolish serfdom because at first she was afraid of her power being too unstable. Then she was busy with other activities, and then by the end of her reign, she became slightly more conservative, kind of ruler, and moreover, she, part of her big program, in fact, probably a cornerstone of her, domestic activities, was the idea of private property, right? And just so we understand, is that, like, now we seem to take it for granted. What does it mean to own something? Like, I own this phone right over here. The issue means, I can destroy it or throw it out of the window. However, these kind of earlier ideas of property, they were pretty complicated. And this notion that owning stuff is to have complete control over it, it was actually a pretty new notion in the 18th century. You see what I'm trying to understand? And so Catherine, she was trying to create this estate of property owners in her nobility. So she had this, like, complex social program. She's going to have these provincial nobles who owned land and provided all the essential government services. Then she had the class of urban merchants and entrepreneurs and craftsmen who also owned property, but of different kind. And so the idea was that, like, after you build these two estates, then you're going to work on the peasants. That's kind of what she was thinking about. So she wasn't going to create property owners and dispossess them immediately afterwards.
So I think we're gonna round it up there and talk about the end of Catherine's reign, because I think we've been talking for over 2 hours now. So, and this is just part one of this series. So let's round it up with talking about the end of Catherine's reign.
It's a great discussion, though, Erland. Like I said, her she died years after the French Revolution had become, right, had begun. So the revolution began in 1789, and Catherine died in 1796. So there is actually a separate and interesting kind of story of how she reacted to that, because Catherine was very much a product of the Enlightenment. She popularized, extracted, works by, and read, obviously, works by Voltaire and Montesquieu and
Didn't
Beccaria.
correspond with Voltaire, though she seemed not to
Yes.
want to come to Russia because she would feel kind of embarrassed, according to Massey, that she even would be disappointed if he came to. But she did have a frequent correspondence with Voltaire.
Yes, exactly. No, I mean, I think work by Isabel de Madariaga is a sort of a better introduction to Catherine's age, her reign. But basically, well, I mean, I think what you're alluding here is this. There's this general question: was Catherine a hypocrite? What was she? Was she just trying to inculcate all these Enlightenment values in her upper classes? Whereas, like, underneath the surface, it was all about power and maintaining control over, these poor, enserfed peasants. So was she just a hypocrite, or maybe she was a fool? Maybe she really did think you can have, separation of powers and liberties and these kind of, like, almost mentally independent elites coexist with serfdom. And that's kind of like a big question. And it seems like from what you're describing, Massey thought that like she was aware of the discrepancy. And it's a big question, but I think there's no doubt that she was a realist. You know, I don't think she thought she was going to produce, you know, the sort of the age of prosperity right away. But it is clear though that when the French Revolution started and you know, the king and his queen got killed, you know, she had a little bit of a scare and cracked down on some of the more, you know, radical figures who were beginning to emerge in Russia. She also ordered her top general, Suvorov, who would be later the bane of French revolutionary generals in the end of the 18th century. She ordered him, you know, mobilized and wanted to send him off to, you know, fight the revolutionaries. So she was considering a military intervention. But it was a bit of, you know, a crisis of the Russian monarchy, like how are you going to deal with Enlightenment values that just took this sharp radical turn.
I think we're gonna round up there. Thank you so much for coming on. We are going to talk next week about the reign from Paul the First, and I'm most likely we call Pavel for, you know, because that was, it was his name was in Russian, and the English Western translation is Paul, of course, but we're most likely gonna call it Pavel until the reign of Nicholas II. So stay tuned for part two next week. Before you go, do you have any social media or any links you want me to put in the description below, or where can people find your book if they want to read your work that you have published so far?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about my current project.
Yeah.
So, well, I think it would be a perfect subject to talk about next time when we discuss the great reforms, because it is about the middle of the 19th century and how power and government changed in Russia during the great reforms, that including criminal justice and criminal law, and that's what I'm writing about right now.
Thank you so much for coming in again. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. I hope you enjoyed part one of our Romanovs mini-series. This has been about that age 12. We are available on Instagram, in Twitter, YouTube, sorry, on social media. We are available on, let me correct that, on Instagram and Twitter under about that age 12. You can find us on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you're on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please consider writing a review. That will help us out a lot. Please like, share, and subscribe, and I'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.